Welcome to a Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Danny, we are in the dead zone right now. So with that being the case, I thought we'd switch gears a little bit, get into some of the news of the day, but then maybe do a little draft talk. I spent a lot of the weekend watching the three guys from Duke and also Kristaps Porzingis, and then also get into a little more some hardcore cap stuff with the Heat's issues. With Dwayne Wade, how's that sound?
Sounds like a plan for me, but we're going to start with news, and there's some news on the injury front in terms of three different players that are more like two, but then there's the whole dynamic with Kevin Love going into the finals.
Yeah, so what I thought was probably more interesting, actually, than the Clay concussion stuff is Kyrie saying to the media that he would need a miracle to be 100%. He's been struggling with that knee tendonitis, and I totally know where he's coming from. I've had that same injury before where you can kind of get it to calm down a little bit. But, you know, you really need a lot of rest and a lot of rehabilitation to get it to where it's not an issue once it gets really bad. So I think that we probably won't expect him to be quite the dynamic presence that he was throughout the regular season and in the beginning of the playoffs. But it does sound like he will at least be playing. I mean, I think the issue is going to be even greater on defense, really, than on offense with this injury.
I agree, especially considering offensively he did better than I ever expected in Game 4, a game that he didn't have much of a need to play in other than getting the rust off, and he looked better than I expected. And defensively, the challenge with this series is where do you put him, and that gets exacerbated if he's not 100%.
Yeah, and certainly once he injured himself, he looked really bad against Derrick Rose to the point where I was even calling for them to just have Rose go one-on-one against him without even using a screen. And he didn't look too good in Game 1 of that Hawks series, and then in Game 4, you know, he wasn't really particularly tested. So I think it's going to be an issue for him. There was also Blatt was asked whether there would be a minutes limit. They weren't sure about that yet. He was on a minutes limit in that Game 4 against the Hawks, so we may see that as well. And maybe there's some possibility, especially if he's going to struggle defensively, that you want to match up his minutes when he is not going against Curry, so that can help maintain their integrity defensively, and also try and use him as a focal point for when James is out of the game, save him for that, and that maybe Dellavedova will play a lot more minutes just so you can stay solid defensively and then just hope that LeBron is enough to carry you home other than that.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the best strategy with a limited Kyrie. Also, that puts you with more time that the non-Warrior starters are on the floor, because something that will be a dynamic in this series is that Kyrie has trouble when they're playing Barnes, Clay, and Steph, but almost every Warriors backup is a substantially inferior offensive player, whether that be Andre Iguodala, Sean Livingston, or Leandro Barbosa, whoever else they're going to use. And so staggering those minutes means it's more likely that he will be facing one or more of those players, which means that you can put him somewhere where it will be less destructive defensively.
Yeah, I mean, really the only guy I think that is an issue there is Livingston potentially posting him up, but then, you know, they probably got somewhere else that they can hide him, like with Iguodala. Livingston and Iguodala usually play together, or Barbosa. So with all that, I think that at least during the non-Curry minutes, they'll be all right with him. The Clay concussion news, not really much going on there. Everyone thinks he's going to play. He went through practice today. I think they just now have to see how he responds to that and if everything's okay, which it seems like it's probably going to be, then he'll be cleared tomorrow, was the impression that I got.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing as well. And, you know, that's encouraging because you want to have everybody's best players out there. You obviously don't want anybody to suffer ill effects from a concussion. So we'll hope, just like we hope with those guys, that he can be at his best or as close to it as he can be.
Concussions are bad. You heard that here first. Okay.
And you don't have to be a Twitter doctor to say that.
Perhaps more interesting were Kevin Love's comments over the weekend, I think on Sunday, to the scrum. He's said that with his shoulder, he was going to try and be ready for the start of next season. And someone asked him if that was going to be with the Cavs, and he said, yes, sir. So it's pretty rare, I think, that I recall someone unequivocally saying like that, that they would be back with the team. Maybe he's just trying to avoid a distraction and he may go back on that, but maybe he really does mean it. Not exactly helping his negotiating power if he really does mean it, because he is going to be a free agent and he could get paid more next year, even if he is going to remain with the Cavs. So we've talked about before why it's unlikely he'll opt in to his, I think it's about $16 million for next year, because he could get a lot more than that, up to about $19 million. So I would expect him to at least re-sign a new contract, even if he does stay there. And we'll see what happens after that. Do you buy it that this just absolutely unequivocally means he's going to be back?
No, I treat it a lot like when they ask a junior in college before his bowl game whether he's going to be back or not, and that they're going to say yes just because they should, but that there's a very distinct chance. I mean, I'm actually working on an article for the Sporting News on this point that should be out in the next couple days, and my interpretation of it, depending on what he wants, which is the big question here, is that the best thing for him in the long term, assuming he wants to be a free agent in 2016, is to do what LeBron did last year and do a 1+1 with Cleveland, and that will give him the maximum money and give him a chance to win.
Yeah, and at least some security then for 2016 if he somehow ends up not being the player that he has been due to this injury, or he gets hurt again or whatever.
And in terms of negotiation, there's a dynamic here which we can talk about with other teams, but that Cleveland doesn't really have the ability with the cap to replace him anyway. So yeah, they wouldn't love to have him on that kind of a deal that leaves them open a little bit, but having him is substantially better than not having him, even if he's underutilized.
Yeah, I agree with that, and Dan Gilbert has shown that he, I think, is willing to spend. He's going to have to spend a lot to bring those guys back, to bring back Thompson on what's looking like it could be close to a maximum deal with the way he's played. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, but you'd imagine that they would make every effort to bring him back no matter what happens in the series. We'll see, though. Last bit of news, a little bit saddening to me personally, at least. David Pick, great reporter out in Europe, reported that Andre Kirilenko has retired now officially after, well, not officially, but according to him, after not being invited to play for Russia at the Eurobasket. And it's a good time to reflect on Kirilenko's career. I think a lot of people forget just what a great player he was, because he was toiling in his best years in absolute obscurity in Utah in the years between when Stockton and Malone retired, and then when Boozer and Mehmet Okur and Deron Williams all came in and they got good again. He was an unbelievable force at, you know, 22, 23 years of age. He actually got a maximum contract extension, and then unfortunately kind of didn't really live up to that. But I think it was partially because he was playing out of position. He was best as a four in his best years, and then when Boozer came in and Okur, he had to play the three, and he was somewhat miscast having to shoot the ball. He was much better offensively around the basket, able to make plays from the elbow, and then defensively he was much better as a shot blocker. He had an insane season the year he was an all-star. I wrote this down earlier. He had an 8.5% block rate the year after he was an all-star at age 23. That was the 04-05 season. 24.4 PR, almost a 600 true shooting percentage in 41 games that year for Utah playing the power forward position. And the year before that, he was an all-star in 03-04 for a Jazz team that everyone thought was going to be the worst in the league and scraped to 500 under Sloan after Stockton and Malone retired. So a shame that he's not someone who ever fulfilled that great potential that he had so young. He got injured, he played out of position, and a guy who I would have loved to have seen in this modern era of the NBA when brutalizing down low isn't so important anymore.
I think about him as the guy who I was the most intrigued by as a 5x5 candidate. I mean, box score stats are what they are.
He basically invented that term.
Yeah.
You know, you never heard about that until he started doing that. I mean, fantasy basketball players are really like the only one who loved him back then. Not that I really play that at all, but he was definitely a legend.
Him and Sean Marion. Those two guys. But Kirilenko was also a guy, you talked about how he had that sky-high PER when he was young. He was one of the guys that I think PER underrated in the sense that he was a very good defender. He wasn't one of those guys who was jacking up a lot of shots, though he was very efficient in it. He provided value all over the court. And like you, I wonder how he could have been used in this era with teams being more willing to use a guy like him at the power forward. And also, he, to me, seemed like one of those guys, and this is something that also exists now, where he was more of a 3-4 defender, not really a perimeter stopper. And those are different things, and they're value to all kinds of good defensive players. And I think that there is a greater understanding for that type of defender now than there was back then.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, he's kind of like, at the time, was a better finishing Draymond Green, but without like that kind of heft. But that's sort of the role that he played. He topped out at about a 21% usage rate, 20% average, obviously, since you have five players on the court. So not really an offensive star, but was so good in all the other aspects of the game, steals, blocking shots. One of the quickest guys off the floor that I can ever remember. He would catch the ball on those baseline cuts and he'd be dunking it like before you could even blink. So really a great player. I wish I'd had League Pass back then to appreciate him a little bit more. And, a guy who's kind of before his time and then, for whatever reason, mostly injuries and playing out of position, I think wasn't able to really make good on that promise that he showed as such a young player.
Yeah, we'll wish them the best moving forward, but he had, and his international career also deserves some respect. He was a huge part in some big Russian success in recent years too.
Oh yeah. I mean, they won the 2007 Eurobasket, I think, at the expense of Spain in Spain. That was the Spanish team that was coming off having won the world championship the year before, and they had all their guys. So he was awesome, playing in David Blatt zones back when Blatt was the coach of the Russian team. So yeah, really, and also really famous for his wife giving him like that one day per year break from their marriage as well. That we have to remember that too. So it's too bad. I mean, be interesting to see. I don't think he would necessarily get some Hall of Fame consideration, but then you see guys with great international resumes kind of get that. I mean, he's obviously not a Hall of Fame worthy player just based on the NBA alone, but when you consider some of his international exploits, maybe he gets some consideration. We'll see. It's kind of a sliding scale for those guys.
Yeah, it can be difficult. You want to move on to the draft guys?
Absolutely, yeah. The first guy I looked at is probably one of the most intriguing guys, mysterious guys in this draft. And I say that not just because he's playing overseas, but more just because he's such an odd amalgam of traits. And that's Kristaps Porzingis out of Latvia. He's playing for Sevilla the last 2 years in the Spanish ACB League, which is, for people who don't know, is basically the second best league in the world.
Yeah, and so that means that he's been facing quality competition from a young age. He's still 19 now. He'll turn 20 before the start of the next season. Where I like to start with a guy like this is a more basic question. That's, who does he defend?
Well, I think he's pretty much straight up a power forward at this point. He is extremely long, 7 feet tall. We don't know his exact wingspan. To my knowledge, he hasn't ever been measured, but it's clear watching him on film that he is just crazy long. But he's really weighs about 220. That might even be optimistic, frankly, given the way his frame looks. So I think he's definitely, going to be defending power forward. Maybe in small lineups, eventually he might be able to play the center position. But the thing about him that's so weird is he's really an excellent shot blocker. And he's a great shooter. But he's also like not really that athletic somehow at the same time. You would look at him, I think, and say, oh, this is just like a soft, like Euro shooting forward, like Zarko Shabarkapa, if I'm pronouncing that right, type of guy. But then you look at his length and the fact that he blocks shots and he'll dunk on people on occasion. And you start to wonder if there's a lot more there, and you see why he's considered such an intriguing prospect by a lot of people.
And there's also the question with him when you think about that he blocks those kind of shots is, will his body be able to transform against the NBA? Because I think that's a big part of his ceiling.
Yeah, I actually don't think that he is that athletic. He'll make some plays that athletic guys would normally make, but they're mostly fueled by his length.
when he blocks shots, he's really good at knocking the ball off the rim. He can get dunks off of alley-oops, and he'll try to go in and dunk on people aggressively, but a lot of it's just the fact that he's 7 feet tall and he has really long arms. He's not getting that high off the ground. And usually when you see really, really skinny guys like him be successful, you'll see someone like Kirilenko, who we just talked about, a guy who's really an athletic dude. KG, you know, when he came in, he was a really skinny guy. He was extremely athletic. Porzingis, not all that quick to me laterally. I think I would consider him at this point below average quickness for an NBA power forward. Not someone who's going to be able to get by people off the dribble at all, I don't think. So a lot of it really, I mean, if he comes into the NBA, he's not going to be effective right now, I don't think. I think there's pretty much no two ways about that. All he's going to be able to do is just shoot three-pointers at this point, and maybe catch some alley-oops in the pick-and-roll, and then probably get, bludgeoned defensively because he's not strong enough. The question is, can he get his body to where he can really compete from a strength standpoint and also get a little bit more athletic? If he can do that, and we've seen some real skinny guys be able to do that, but they kind of start off a little more athletic as well, then I think he could be a real player and someone who could be maybe even like a borderline all-star type of guy. If he can't do that, he could be, a pretty big bust.
And the other reason why Porzingis is compelling is that he can shoot. And so when you think about him as a power forward, or conceptually if he could ever become a center, is that he has that range. So you're combining a guy who has some traits that you really, really like in an NBA player right now. And so the questions can be how you put those pieces together, but he does have some key high points that could be very useful.
Yeah, that's what really offensively the biggest thing about him is his shooting ability. And he can even come off of screens every once in a while. In the post, he's shown some ability to shoot a turnaround jumper. He's got a pretty quick release. He's got the ability to get his body around and shoot the ball when he's not quite square. He's got limitless range, too. He'll fire it from, 30 feet away, no problem. Still not, he's not quite automatic as far as making it yet. I would say that his shot's a little bit flatter, a little bit more similar to kind of like an Andrea Bargnani type of shot than a Dirk Nowitzki type of shot. He doesn't have quite the same level of arc that someone like Nowitzki has. He shot 37% overall in all competitions, both the Euro Cup and the ACB League. He was a little bit worse in the ACB League, but I don't make anything particular of that. So that's his number one attribute, is going to be a shooting, no problem shooting it out of pick and pop with that footwork. It remains to be seen whether he, in the NBA, he actually ends up being a Nowitzki level of shooter or a Bargnani type of shooter or somewhere in between. I would lean maybe towards somewhere in between. I don't know that I see him necessarily, and you never know with this type of stuff, but necessarily becoming a deadly, over 40% three-point shooter. I think he's more like a 37-38% kind of guy, and that's what he shot this year in Europe.
But that said, I think even at 37, at 37%, he has enough gravity to make defenses have to respect him.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, it certainly will be someone that you have to guard out there. And his ability to come off screens is pretty cool. That's not something that a lot of four men are used to playing. I think early on in his career, he's someone who could probably be defended pretty easily by a wing. He's not going to be strong enough to post up. But if he gets enough strength, then he can be the type of guy who can post up and shoot a turnaround. Not a guy who gets to the foul line a lot, though, which is a little bit troublesome. You worry about that kind of playing into the softness narrative. Maybe that's something that improves as he gets stronger. But, yeah, I think he's definitely quite a risk. If he weren't really long the way he is, I wouldn't be excited about him at all. And I think defensively as well, other than the shot blocking, he's not really bringing much to the table. I don't see him being that quick laterally at this point, not really strong enough. His instincts are not particularly refined either. He'll block some shots, but he's not doing a ton else. On the boards, really, defensive boards, he's really not very good either. A little better on the offensive glass when he can kind of get a running start and go up over people.
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge for me to really figure out what what his calling card is, but how his aggregate value is high enough to justify taking him as high in the lottery as some people are rumored to be interested in him.
Yeah, I mean, I do think he's really risky. I mean, a lot of things need to go right for him to be good. I mean, he has some of the raw tools, the shooting ability and the length, but that's really all you're dealing with at this point that he has in his toolbox. I mean, he's got to get stronger. He's got to still improve his shooting even more. He's got to really improve his basketball IQ. He's got to improve his lateral quickness. He's not really someone who can do anything off the drive yet. He's going to have to improve that. And he's got to improve his post game. But all those things to be the type of guy who you're going to be picking, you know, in the 5, 6, 7 range where people are talking about. I mean, I think kind of the consensus right now is that he's the 5th best prospect in the draft after those top 4 guys. And, you know, I think with how far he has to go, he definitely has upside. Like, don't get me wrong. But I think that the chance of him realizing that is not necessarily as certain as some people think. So, you know, I might worry a little bit about taking him in that 5-6 range, you know, maybe more of like a late in the top 10 type of guy. But I haven't watched everyone else yet. You know, maybe he is the 5th best guy and I just haven't seen them yet. But just in terms of like watching him and sort of comparing him in my mind to the type of prospects who have gone in that range, you know, he doesn't strike me as like a surefire top 5 prospect kind of guy at this point.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting at this point in the process kind of do that because you're in the abstract to a point where you're trying to figure everybody out. The team that I've thought of, he's not my favorite pick for them, but he would be fun to see in Utah where they can afford to develop him over a little bit of time. And
he'll be before then, though.
Yeah, I agree. Unless they really wanted to move up for him. But yeah, I'm worried with him that he'll end up in the wrong situation. And that's sometimes it's something I talk about a fair amount. I think it's better for guys to fall a little bit. Yeah, they make a little bit less money on their first contract, but they can get to a place where by the end of their 4th year, when they're looking for something new, they'll be in the right spot.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of it is going to depend on just how committed he is to working on his bike. From what I hear, I mean, I don't know him personally, but I hear that he is really into working hard on his game, that he's very dedicated, speaks English, so that's something that won't be an issue for him like it is for a lot of guys in their first year or two. But, I mean, I think the question is going to be, you know, is he willing to stay in the U.S. and work hard on his strength training to get to the level that he needs to be at, you know, or is he going to go home and kind of, you know, not get that strong the way certain Europeans have in the past. So, I think that's about all I have to say on him really at this point. But, you know, certainly a really, really intriguing prospect for sure. I mean, I guess a few stats, and this is one thing that might make you feel pretty good about him. I mean, he's, you know, a 19-year-old kid in the ACB league holding his own is pretty impressive. And he had a 585 true shooting percentage, which is excellent. A lot of that's due to his 3-point percentage, and also managed a 25% usage rate, playing about half the game. So that's just the fact that he's able to get that many shots off and, you know, hit them at a reasonable rate is very encouraging as well. And I think the statistical translation, certain of them are higher on him than others. I know Kevin Pelton's really liked him, because his translations think a lot of the ACB league, which most do. Some other translations have him down in the teens. So, you know, the stats apparently have just as much variability in their opinion of him as, you know, we do as far as his upside and his downside.
Do you have anything else on Porzingis, or do you want to move on to the next guy?
No, I think that's about it. I mean, it's just, he kind of, it's funny, like watching him move around, he's very cultish in a way, right? Like you just, you know, like a newborn colt who just, you can see like what they could develop into, but kind of a little rickety moving around, but you think, all right, once this guy gets stronger and grows into his body, like, he could really be something. So we'll see what happens with him. You know, I think it's not the upside that makes me a little bit less sanguine about his prospects so much as it is simply the probability that he actually realizes that upside, because he does have a long way to go.
A guy that we have a more clear vision of how he's going to contribute is Jahlil Okafor. You watched more film on him this weekend. What do you think now? Is there anything you think now that you didn't think a week ago?
Oh, you know, I mean, I hadn't watched him much in college. Being from Chicago, I had always kept an eye on him and watched a couple of his high school games per year. He was absolutely dominant as a 17-year-old at the Under-19 World Championships in 2013. So I watched all of those games. And when he shot, I think, 77% from the field in that competition. And then, you know, I saw him at Nations in 2013 and then the Hoop Summit. So pretty familiar with his game before this year. Really, I think, you know, we talk about what his weaknesses are, and there are two big questions for me about what he can be. The first of those questions is, how real is this post-scoring? And when I say that, it's because he shot, there's a site called hoopmath.com that basically breaks up shots at the college level into layups, mid-range, and three-point shots. And Okafor, he shot 50% on what are considered two-point jump shots by them, which is basically a non-layup. And so a lot of that's, you know, hook shots, turnaround jumpers, shots that aren't right at the basket. And that's a huge sample for him. You know, he shot 80 out of 160 on those shots. And only 31 of those are assisted. So that means he's posting up. He's shot not right at the basket. He's hitting 50% on a crazy number of attempts for a college big guy. Does that sustain in the NBA? I mean, basically nobody is able to shoot like that.
And consider that he also shot 51%, I think, from the line.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure what to make of that. I mean, most of his, you know, when it's considered two-point jumper on Hoop Math, but not many of those are actual jump shots with two hands on the ball. A lot of it is hook shots. He's got, you know, really the best touch on his hook shot of anyone I've ever seen from his age. He's got these enormous hands, great using the glass, you know, and the ball just goes in the basket off of his hand on shots where that would be bad shots for most big men in college, not to mention, you know, even in the NBA. And yet, you know, he's able to create a little bit of separation with his body, get great extension, and the ball just kisses in off the glass. It's beautiful. He's able to use both hands reasonably well. His left hand could use it a little more, but for considering where he is, he's pretty good with it. So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, can he hit those type of shots at a 50% rate in the NBA? Because if so, that's going to be really, really hard to stop.
Yeah, and he also has a lot of other offensive gifts that are unusual for a guy with his background, including his passing and ability to handle double teams, which, if you're drafting him that high, you hope he's going to command at the NBA.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, I mean, he'll kind of dribble out a little bit sometimes when he gets double teamed. But he never panics. He's able to use those big hands again to hold the ball away from the defenders and make passes. I mean, the way he uses his hands is pretty remarkable. He catches everything too. Real good on the pick and roll, just catching it. Almost never commits an offensive foul, which is pretty remarkable when you consider he's a guy who is, you know, 6'11 with a 7'5 wingspan and, you know, weighed about 270 during the year. He looks to have slimmed up a little bit, from photos that we've seen lately, but, yeah, I mean, to never commit an offensive foul, he has all the moves in the book. The great hook shot, he can hit a turnaround, jump shot off the glass. He loves spin moves as well. Doesn't get to the line a ton, but that's because, you know, he's a little bit more of a finesse guy. Doesn't get a ton of deep seals either, but that's because he doesn't need a deep seal to score. At least he hasn't yet in his career. I would like to see him do that a little bit more with the big body that he has and get to the foul line a little bit more, but you know, when he was shooting 51% from the foul line and he's shooting 50% on, like, you know, his hook shots, which aren't going to draw a ton of fouls, maybe you just shoot that shot. So I don't know. I think he's going to do better at the foul line. Like, he's got a pretty good touch, not terrible form. My hope is that that's just a mental thing or an aberration that'll dissipate somewhat once he gets in the NBA.
I had Sam Vecenie on the Real GM Radio podcast, and the comparison he made was to DeMarcus Cousins. How do you feel about that?
That's an interesting one, right? I mean, that is the most logical comparison, and I'm glad that Sam made that because I haven't heard anyone else do that yet. And I think that's right. You know, DeMarcus was drafted number 5, probably would have gone higher had it not been for supposed character concerns.
Which Okafor does not have, correct?
Yeah, no. He is a great, you know, hard worker, great kid by all accounts, you know, as a lot of Duke kids are, frankly. So he, and I think Okafor is more skilled around the basket. I don't think there's really, you know, you'd have to go back years and years. I mean, maybe to Tim Duncan to find a college big man who had this type of skill level and around the basket and this type of touch. DeMarcus got to the line a lot more than Okafor did. And probably DeMarcus has always had a better outside jumper. But DeMarcus is stronger and he plays a lot stronger and harder and is a much better rebounder. That's Jaleel's probably his biggest weakness, from a rebounding standpoint is on the defensive glass. He's great carving out space on the offensive glass. He had a 15% offensive rebound rate, which is awesome. He's really good at that, but then he only had an 18% defensive rebounding rate, which is really bad when you consider his size and, you know, what he's able to do, with his long arms and his great hands. So he's not a guy who's going to sky up in traffic and go get the ball like you often have to on defensive rebounds. He's better at carving out that space right at the rim for tip-ins and such, on the offensive glass.
And his other big weakness is rim protection. You can put it in a couple different ways. And I mean, his block rate is scary for when I think of a center, I think of a guy who their main job is protecting the rim. And while he does a lot of other things well, at least so far, that is not something that he has as a strength.
Yeah. You say at least so far. And I think there are a couple of aspects of that. He's never been in the most amazing shape. He's never had the most cut body. But you also have to remember, he actually played 30 minutes a game as a college big man. They didn't really have much else backing him up. So basically, when you're his level of offensive player in college, you're essentially, defense isn't so much about stopping the other team as it is just not getting into foul trouble. And so, you know, he managed to play that many minutes. You know, DeMarcus Cousins, for example, only played like 20 minutes a game, 23 minutes a game when he was at Kentucky. So they needed him to stay on the floor. I think that impacted things a lot. So, you can kind of use that as an excuse, but he did only have that 5% two-point block rate, which is really bad for any college big man, not to mention someone with the type of length that he has. He does, however, have quick feet relative to his size, which he uses on offense. I think in pick-and-roll defense, he can use that. You know, he has the big body. I think once he gets into the NBA, if he can learn to jump straight up and become comfortable with the fact that they're not going to call a foul on him when he does that, because college refs will call a foul on a big guy no matter what. Like, you know, there's no, the whole verticality thing, like, you're not getting that in college. Like, if someone drives in and there's contact, like, usually it's going to be a foul. Like, college basketball has, like, I think about 50% more fouls per possession than pro basketball does. So, or the NBA does. So I think that there's some hope for him, but the fact is, he's not good at it now. You're just projecting and hoping. You know, he's not doesn't probably ever project to be a great defensive player. I don't think it's really in his DNA that much. So yeah, that's always a worry when you have a center who, as good as he is offensively, can't protect the basket. We've seen how teams have had trouble building around guys like that. And so that's the biggest concern about him is defensively, because that's a center's primary job.
And that gets into the idea of where you take him in the draft, because there are different groups, and obviously some of it depends on other people's talent, but when you watched him, did you think this is a top two, possibly a top one pick, or were you thinking more in the, like, top five range?
You know, it's interesting. I think that, and I haven't watched that much of Towns, but just based on kind of what he is you know, what I think he can be, especially if he can shoot the three, I think Towns would be the clear pick for me over Okafor. And, you know, maybe if I watch more film of him, that will change my opinion. But at this point, I think Okafor is kind of in that range now of 2 to 5. And I haven't watched much of Russell yet or that much of Moutier either. So I think that's about it. I mean, when you consider just like how good he is at what he does, it almost seems like a crime to have him lower than the second pick, because he's just such a good post scorer, and that's something that just is almost unprecedented in some ways in the last 20 years or so, really since Tim Duncan, I think. But on the other hand, when you just consider what his limitations are from a team building perspective, and you kind of go outward and think about what having him on your team means for building the rest of your team, and how important defense is at the center position, then you start to wonder a little bit. So that's going to be the key for me is, you know, I think he's a smart guy. I think he can improve his awareness. But, you know, there's no reason why, from a physical standpoint, he can't be as good as Marc Gasol is. But does he have that mentality, you know, defensively? And is that what's really important to him? Or is it just going to be scoring? That's what we're going to find out. And you have to price it in the fact that he never does get it on defense. And that's why, you know, I think you have to worry about potentially taking him as the number one pick because of what the potential for a bad defensive center can mean for your team.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. And one of the things that excites me so much about having him in the league is that there have been people who've talked about the death of the big man and especially the back to the basket. And for me, it's always been more of a supply issue that there aren't many human beings that can do what you need, what a back to the basket player needs to do with today's defensive rules. And if it can work, it'll probably be somebody like Jahlil Okafor. And so I'm intrigued by how that will work because it's a great test case.
One reason I do like him is if he catches the ball out on the floor, that's not the death knell for his post up. He's very nimble. He's good at backing down, using those spin moves. If he catches the ball 15, 17 feet from the basket, if he gets pushed out or they're trying to front him, that's not going to mean that he's not going to be able to score on that possession. So that's kind of nice that you can still get him the ball without it having to be right there on the block. That's another reason to really like what he can do offensively.
And that's so different than a guy like Dwight Howard. Dwight is physically dominant, and even at his best stages, he did a great job of being able to get inside and, you know, be able to get those dunks, but you can use him in a different way there, and his passing is such a huge advantage.
Yeah, and I think he will get to the point where he'll get a nice little Tim Duncan jump shot off the glass as well. So, all right, well, so why don't we can save the other two Duke guys for later in the week since we're going to have some more downtime. Why don't we get into the situation with Dwayne Wade and the Miami Heat now, where he is, you know, through his agent has been making some noise that he is going to opt out of his contract and wants to sign a longer term / more expensive deal with the Heat.
Yeah, so there are a lot of complex issues here. Some of them are just the sheer math of it, and other parts are far more emotionally complicated than that. And the fact of the matter is, whether you want to say that it matters or not, Dwayne Wade has taken a pay cut on his last two contracts in order to facilitate.
Oh, and it does matter.
I mean, oh, absolutely it matters. And he's taken he took a pay cut to bring in LeBron James and Chris Bosh. That clearly worked out. But then also, he opted out of his contract last summer and took less money to help facilitate a better team this year.
Yeah, so to remind, I mean, the idea was that he was going to take less and they might try and use their cap space, but then LeBron didn't come back. He had already agreed to what was basically a two-year, $31 million deal, and he had over $40 million coming to him over those 2 years originally. He opted out. So from his perspective, what he's probably thinking now is, hey, not only do you need to pay me market value, but you need to pay me $9 million more than market value over the rest of my career. And that's not even considering the time value of money that he gave up either. So that's where I think he's coming from is, look, you want to show me some loyalty here. You need to actually pay me more than I'm worth.
Yeah, and that's where it gets sort of sticky. It depends on how you see it for Miami, because Miami has a lot of obligations. They have about $45 million in money that is assured to people, whether that be Chris Bosh's huge contract and other things. But they also have the most complicated trio of potential free agents in this free agency group, because Wade, Deng, and Dragic are all player option guys who, if they opt out, and I think everybody expects all three of them to become unrestricted free agents, which means that Miami can retain them. You know, they're going to have the ability to do that, but they're probably all going to be expensive. And doing so impacts their flexibility moving forward.
Yeah, so let's set the scene a little bit. And a lot of where I'm getting this from is from a great article on heathoops.com by Albert Random One. Great follow on Twitter, by the way. Probably one of the best cap dorks out there. And I say that with the greatest affection. So check that article out. It's his most recent one to even get into this nitty-gritty a little more. So you recall that they gave up 2017 and 2021 first-round draft picks to get Goran Dragic. That was a very complex transaction. Dragic, Bill Duffy did a great job maneuvering him to Miami to where he wanted to be, where he could be a lead ball handler and someone that was would still have his bird rights and would be able to give him a fifth year because, you know, he's going to be 29. And so getting that fifth year is important. You kind of force them to overpay in the beginning or overpay at the end to get you there in the beginning. And so Dragic is going to be wanting a maximum salary. That would be starting at about $19 million and total be a five-year, $109 million contract, which, you know, would be pretty massive, but maybe not as bad once the cap goes up. He'd be making almost $25 million in the last year of that deal in the 2019-2020 season. So if they pay that much for him, and that's what he's going to be asking for, he knows that they gave up the two first-round picks for him already. They want him to take a lot less, but he's never made a ton of money in his career. He only really about $40 million or so. So they might try to get him to take less, but he can just leave, and he doesn't have anything really tying him there other than their ability to offer that fifth year. Maybe they can get a little bit of a discount on him, or at least maybe get his salary to go down a little bit for next year so they can bring in some more free agents. But I imagine he's going to be pretty darn close to that maximum extension level. It would be a coup for them if they can get him for less. So that's issue number one with him. So you assume he's going to start around $19 million for this next year. Then Wade is at $16 million. He probably would say, hey, you know, pay me $22 million. That's my max this year. I gave up this money. I'm going to opt out. You pay me that much this year. And then maybe, you know, for 2016, I can reduce it, you know, now that I'm close to being made whole for what I opted out of. And that seems like a great solution, right? Except the problem is the luxury tax for this year. That's one of the issues. And then Luol Deng, too, he's due $10 million this year. He might opt out after having a decent year and want either more years or more money for this next year. So there's now two components. One is from the Heat that are unpalatable here. One is they might have to pay a lot of luxury tax this year, and we'll get into that. And component number two is they have to pay Hassan Whiteside and potentially any free agents that they might want to get up to, including Kevin Durant, next summer, and so they don't want to have anything that's going to impact their salary for next summer.
Do we want to get into the salary nerd thing with Hassan Whiteside now?
Yeah, so that's really kind of step one here, too, that's overarching is the Heat did a great job, right? They got him at a minimum contract for last year and this next year, one of the biggest bargains in the league. If he continues to play the way he played for much of last year, he's going to well outperform that. So great, right? So now when he's a free agent, they can just exceed the salary cap to re-sign him. Well, not quite so easy because, unfortunately, he'll have only been on the team for 2 years. And that means that they have what's called his early bird rights instead of full bird rights. Full bird rights means you can exceed the salary cap however much you want up to the maximum salary. But he has to have been on the team or, you know, have been under the same contract and traded from another team to get that. With only 2 years, they can exceed the cap, but only in one of two ways. One is by paying him up to 175% of his previous salary. That doesn't help you at all because he's making $981,000 next year. So that's less than $2 million. Number two, they can pay him the estimated average player salary, which will probably be about $6 million or so to start in the 2016 season. Neither of those is going to come close to being how much he wants. So now that means to give him market value, you have to exceed or you have to provide salary cap room under what will be about an $89 million cap that year. So they have, if they want to keep him, you got to save some room, and you have to imagine he might make up to the maximum salary if he continues to play the way he has.
And so that means that any commitments they make beyond next year to guys like Luol Deng are making that more complicated, plus the fact that a lot of their other players, Mario Chalmers, Udonis Haslem, Birdman, are all becoming free agents that same year too, and that all runs together if you're going to be using cap space for Hassan Whiteside.
Yeah, it does. And so really, let's say that you wanted to maintain a maximum slot for a salary, whether it's Whiteside, whether it's someone coming in as an outside free agent for the summer of 2016. If you're going to do that, as Albert's article says, basically the most you can be paying Dwayne Wade for that season is $12.5 million. That doesn't really sound like a number he would be happy at, does it?
No, it really doesn't. Especially when you consider the amount that raises and drops have to go in. So you can't be in that situation where he's like, hey, I want to get $20 million this year to get made whole, and then I can drop down to $12 million. That's not allowed under the current rules.
Not if it's under the same contract. Now, what they could do, which is a good suggestion that Albert had, was, all right, you pay him his maximum this year, his $22 million, and then he opts out and he re-signs for, you know, the $12.5 million or a little bit less than that in 2016, or you just have a one-year contract with him. But then the problem is they are going to have to pay a ton of luxury tax if they do that.
Yeah, and they're paying a ton of luxury tax for a team that would be very good, but maybe not. I wouldn't say they would necessarily be the title favorites even in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, and for those who don't recall the way the luxury tax works, the tax level will probably be right around $82 million in this next year. If they just brought back, if they re-signed Dragic for $19 million and then just brought back Wade and Deng at $16 and $10 million respectively, you're already at $93 million. So you're $10 million over. And the way it works is it's you have to pay more and more as you go up by each $5 million increment, right? So let's say you are $5 million over. That means you have to pay that $5 million, obviously, to the players. But then if you are the Heat, well, here, we'll start with the normal first. Then you have to pay $1.50 for on that $5 million in addition. So you're basically paying $12 million for the privilege of being $5 million over. Now, because of all those times in the LeBron James years when the Heat were already over the tax, if they're over the tax this year, they have to pay the repeater tax. And so that means now that you're paying another dollar. So that would be for the first $5 million over, they're now paying $2.50 to the league for each dollar. So that means that they're $5 million over, it's another $12.5 million to the league. And then it goes up even further. It'd be $2.75 for the next $5 million increment. And so if they do that, let's say if they're at just that $93 million, now you're paying $26 million in luxury tax already. And so $93 million, $26 million, you know, now you're into like, you know, almost $120 million in salary and luxury tax. That's way, way more than the Heat have ever paid. And then when you consider, you know, if you wanted to use the mini mid-level to bring somebody else in, then you're even higher than that, you know, and you're getting into the $3.50 for the next bracket, $3.50 per dollar in the next bracket. It could get insanely expensive. And, you know, one of the scenarios Albert has them paying as much as $150 million in salary and luxury tax. Not something I think Mickey Arison is going to do, considering that he wouldn't even do that when he had LeBron James on the team.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the math on this does not work in their favor. And also, yeah, as you said, the repeater tax is what makes this especially punitive because of the timing of everything. Because they didn't, as from what I recall, they didn't pay the luxury tax this year. But having one clear year isn't enough to avoid the repeater tax.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, they want to. I don't see any way that they avoid the tax this upcoming year. I mean, they need Luol Deng, they need Wade if they're going to be good. So I mean, they're going to be paying some tax. They may have to just pay the repeater tax. And then when you look at their 2016 plans, now if you Wade wants a contract that goes beyond just this year, if Deng wants a contract that goes beyond just this year, now you're pretty much automatically saying goodbye to Whiteside next year. And goodbye to any chance that you're going to get somebody in 2016. So it's really, really difficult now if you're Pat Riley. Do you want to compromise your 2016 plan to remain loyal to Dwayne Wade? You know, maybe they can kind of dump some salary. You know, they might be able to move on from Birdman. He's owed $5 million this year. You know, and that's, I mean, and you have to remember every $5 million that they can get rid of, that basically saves them $17.5 million if it's the first $5 million over the tax, and way more than that even if it's more than that. So you see now how difficult the tax can really be, especially for a team that's not, you know, a huge market team that's making a ton from their TV deal. And it doesn't really make sense. I mean, you can say, all right, you know, Birdman is a valuable player, but, you know, is he worth paying $23 million extra dollars to have this guy on our team when we can, you know, he wasn't that good last year? So, I mean, we may see them try and stretch guys, you know, spread that over 3 years. Josh McRoberts has three more years on his deal at about, you know, an average of $5.7 million over those 3 years. They may try to move on from him. I think he's someone who's actually a value contract, though. They need him. They need a third big on the team. Mario Chalmers, $4.3 million. Haslam, $2.8 million. You know, those guys are all people that they could try to move on from, but they may have to pay a price in draft picks or something else to do that. And you don't necessarily want to stretch those guys because then that gets into your 2016 salary space. So it's really difficult for them right now.
And you also have the issue of timing, because when you think about those players and you think that you'd like to move on from them, maybe if everything goes well, doing that, let's say, towards the end of the season, because the luxury tax isn't calculated till the end of the year. So if you wanted to move on, let's say, at the deadline to try to get some value out of them and everything like that, there aren't as many teams that would either A, be willing to do it, or B, have the leverage to extract more resources out of you. So it puts them in a stickier spot. And then if you're saying, oh, well, you need to try to move those guys in the summer, that's when you're negotiating with everybody else. And so you're trying to get Dwayne Wade to come back, or trying to get Luol Deng. And at the same time, you're negotiating and try to reduce your tax burden. It's incredibly complicated.
And, you know, does Mickey Arison want to pay well over $100 million? I mean, he's basically no way to not pay over $100 million at this point. But I think, you know, unless they really gut the roster. But, you know, even more than that, potentially, is a starting five of Dragic, Wade, Deng, and Bosch,
and
Whiteside. Is that a championship team? Maybe if everything goes well, but those guys are all pretty limited from a health standpoint, too. You know, Dwayne Wade's not going to play a ton of minutes or play a ton of games, so you got to have some depth as well. I mean, maybe if everything breaks right, that's a finals team out of the East, but I don't know, man. That is a lot of money to pay for a team that is not really even necessarily, even on your best day, going to be a finals team.
And that is not projecting to get better. This isn't locking up Harden, Ibaka, Durant, and Westbrook when they're young and you're thinking, oh my God, these guys are 22. When they're 28, they're going to be world beaters. These are guys who are at or past their prime. And so you're spending that money for a team that also probably, in my eyes, would not have home court advantage in the East because of the way that Dwayne Wade's health is and everything like that, and considering the Hawks and the Cavs are probably going to be strong next year. So they're going to, you have to think, can this team win a road game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals? And if they do that, can they win it? And if they do that, then what are you carrying on, and how does that help you or hurt you in 2016?
So, yeah, I mean, and this team is really going to struggle for spacing, I think. You know, maybe they can get someone who will help with that number 10 pick that they're able to retain. But, you know, that's a rookie, probably not going to be a guy who helps immediately, especially if you want him to have any kind of upside. But, you know, with Wade and Deng, having Bosch back, McRoberts can shoot a little bit too. But, and then, you know, Whiteside, not really a guy who's going to operate away from the basket. When you don't have Bosch in the game, you might struggle for enough spacing to get as much out of your team offensively as those guys' talents might indicate that you could.
And they don't have that true guard defender. You know, they have guys who Wade's probably going to slow down defensively. Dragic is, you know, he's not horrendous, but he's not.
Yeah, I mean, if Wade slows down anymore in its transition defense, he's just going to be like, you know, playing the Vivek style at this point.
Thank you for bringing that up.
So, yeah, it's and actually, you know, I should say this. I don't make fun of Vivek nearly as much for that as a lot of people do. I mean, I think there's a lot of something to be said for a free exchange of ideas, to try things outside the box, just to see whether it works. You know, I mean, maybe you might try that and it would be a complete disaster. But, you know, if you wanted to just have your D-League team play like that for a couple games, like, why not? What's the cost? Like, just see whether it would work or not, because, you know, they're not a team that's going anywhere. But anyway, that's a total non sequitur, but I think that he gets a little bit too much criticism for that when those are the sort of things you should be at least trying to think about.
Anybody who's read my material knows that I'm pretty much a supporter of trying anything to see if it works, and the status quo is not a justification for it. So I'm on board with that too. I think the way that it was presented was a little bit funny, but that's a very silly thing to do. You don't criticize somebody for that. You talk about the strength of the ideas.
I mean, for any doctors who may be looking to commit me right now for defending that strategy, I mean, I think there's like a 0.1% chance that that would ever work, but why not? Give it a shot. Like, or at least, at the very least, maybe if you don't try it, the fact that you are just bringing it up as a potential idea, like, that doesn't make you a crazy person in my mind. Maybe so, some other things could, but not that necessarily.
And we might talk about those another day.
All right, I think that'll wrap us up for today. I hope you found this cap nerd talk interesting. Definitely check out Albert's piece on Heat Hoops. Also the draft stuff. If this was too deep for us, let me know and we can tone it down a little bit. But I enjoy getting into this level of minutia. We'll see whether the audience does too. So thanks a lot for listening. You can subscribe at Real GM, our kind hosts. Go to the Dunkdown page there, iTunes, XML link, easy way to subscribe. Daniel is Danny LaRue on Twitter. I am Nate Duncan NBA. Follow us both there throughout the finals for some good live tweeting action. And we will talk to y'all tomorrow night. Thanks for listening.